Hello and welcome to The Sacred. This is a podcast about the things that are deep and meaningful and precious to us, our deepest values that we try and live by, and how we can get better at engaging across our deep differences in these extremely divided times. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and every episode I speak to someone who has some kind of public voice or platform. I kick off by asking them to reflect on what their sacred or deepest values are, the things they try to live by, really. Being a bit nosy about their childhood and the ideas that were around as they were growing up. And then zooming out to the ideas they're interested in now and how they might help us build our empathy and our ability to have a healthier common life. I deliberately speak to people from a range of perspectives, backgrounds, and beliefs. I have learnt loads and been challenged in my thinking by almost every guest, and I hope you will be too. As always, please get in touch. You can find me on Twitter at ESOldfield, and please do rate, review, and recommend the podcast to others if you find it at all helpful. There's one key way you can support the project. In this episode, you'll hear a conversation I had with Eli Pariser. Eli has had a long and distinguished career in tech, entrepreneurship, and is currently running the organization New Public, which is trying to help thinkers, designers, and technologists build the digital public spaces of the future. That's a bit of a mouthful, but it will make more sense once you've listened. He helped set up Move On and Avaaz, which were really pioneers in the digital organizing space in those early days of the internet. And if you recognize his name, despite not being at all connected with those kind of worlds, it's probably because in 2011, he coined the term filter bubble and wrote the New York Times best-selling book of the same name. We had a really interesting conversation about some of the trends that have led to our current situation in terms of division, many of which he predicted with terrifying accuracy, actually, back in 2011. We discussed his sacred value of curiosity, his abiding and actually quite inspiring love for democracy, and why we need to build shared public digital spaces in the same way that we now have public parks. There was a little bit of background noise in Eli's New York apartment, so you can hear a little bit of people moving around, a bit of sirens, but I don't think it's too distracting. As usual with this series, there are some reflections for me at the end of the episode after I've had a chance to chew over the conversation. So stay tuned for that if you'd like to. But it's enough from me for now. I really hope you enjoy listening. Eli, we're going to go deep, quick. No chit-chat. I'm going to ask what's sacred to you. And you've had a bit of time to think about it. It doesn't really matter how this lands in the sense of you can challenge the premise of the question, you can take it in a different direction, but I hope it's just opened up slightly different space in your brain to think about what your values are, your deep principles, the things you've tried to live by, even if, as all of us do, you have failed at times. Mm-hmm. What bubbled up in the small amount of time I'm sure that you've had to think about it?
The thing that actually came to my mind first was curiosity. And I only realized recently, like, how much that idea of curiosity and the kind of like more religious or spiritual idea of witness kind of like can fit in together. You know, that really when you're acting in a fully curious way, part of what's so uplifting and transporting is, you know, just sort of like really getting to see the world as it is, which is amazing, you know, and which is jaw-dropping and so interesting. And so so I sort of feel like with people, with systems, with myself, like when I can like get into that fully, like I rarely feel like it leads me astray.
Can you say a bit more about that religious or spiritual concept of witness?
I'm not like an expert in it. I just was, you know, talking to someone who comes from a traditional kind of religious background. I'm part of like a group feelings discussion thing, sort of group therapy, but not even as like formal as that. And we were having this discussion about like, I was like, I feel kind of bad because, you know, I hear about what other people are going through and all of the like real challenges that they're facing in their lives and how they're feeling about it and the complexity of that and the difficulty of that. And like, I come out of these meetings often, you know, and I share my own, but I come out like feeling so like euphorically uplifted. I was like, am I just like some kind of like, you know, whatever, like, you know,
feeding pain, on people's pain, pain
vampire. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And she was like, this is kind of like actually like a core piece of the human experience, which is like, you know, actually seeing other people fully and allowing yourself to be seen is this kind of just in and of itself and separate from, because it's not like the euphoria comes from like, oh, I guess like my problems aren't so bad because someone else's are worse. It isn't comparative in that way. It really is just this feeling of like, oh, like here we are being humans in all of what that is. And that's quite something, you know, and like somehow, you know, makes my skin tingle, you know, sort of that concept, which is really not about like problem solving or categorization even, but just is about like being seen and understood. And that got me.
Yeah. Chaplains call it accompaniment. And it's making me think of Martin Buber, who I quote far too much, but his whole thing is those moments where you really see each other, those idyll moments. That's the only thing that's really real.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everything else is kind of like background noise. Like we're only fully alive and fully a human and fully ourselves in those moments of, oh, wow, you, like you in all your complexity. And then he really relates that to God. Can you think of an example where curiosity, that deep value, has affected your choices or your decisions in life? A fork in the road or a kind of dilemma where you've kind of chosen curiosity and it's changed what you might have done?
I think it's present in most of my big decisions. It's a way of getting beyond like the initial schema or the initial reactions or the initial impressions that you have about what the decision even is. One of the books that made the most impact on me is this book called The Person in the Situation, which is really about the dance between like our idea that like character is so important and who we are is this kind of like unchangeable thing. And the fact that actually like when you observe human behavior, people really show up really differently in different situations, and predictably so. Part of the argument of the book is that like that the situations we're in shape our behavior way more than we give them credit for. And but part of what that's about is like even really understanding what situation it is. And so I feel like that's where curiosity comes in, because like that's such a critical tool to know like is this even the right decision? Am I understanding what the decisions are now?
I'd love you to paint us a picture of your childhood. Tell us a little bit about where and how you grew up, with particular reference to any big ideas that were around, political, philosophical, religious, that you have a hunch might have been formative for good or ill.
I grew up in a small town in Maine, in northern United States, 900 people. And my parents were, you know, had moved there from the city and were kind of like back to the land people, and had started an alternative high school that was really built around this idea of kind of serving kids who were mostly like lower income kids and who had dropped out of high school and who generally like hadn't had like good adult relationships in their lives. And so the idea with the school was, let's start with that relational context and then let's kind of like build on that to do the actual like, here's what math you need to know. But that if we don't have that kind of like infrastructure of trust and care, then there's like not that much that you can build on educationally. It was a nonprofit school. My parents kind of paid themselves as little as they could kind of get away with to run our family. And, you know, and there was this real sense of kind of like this being of service and of use to a community of people is a really like important part of life. You know, somewhere early on, someone kind of shared with me, maybe it was my parents, you know, this idea of kind of the birth lottery, and that, you know, one way to think about how just or unjust the world is the thing about like, well, how much would I want to like randomly be born anywhere to anyone at any, you know, at any place or socioeconomic class. And I think that definitely like was a big idea for me, like as a kid of like, I happen to have landed in a place that is wonderful in so many ways. And like, that's not totally fair. And part of what I want to do is like, try to spend some of my time trying to increase the birth lottery odds for everyone.
So that really helps me make sense of, as I've kind of been reading about you and thinking about you, it's clear really that it's social purpose first, tech second, that you are someone who uses tech or seeks to use tech as a social tool to bring about this sense of, you're an activist, essentially. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's definitely always been part of my, big part of my DNA, and wanting to kind of like, help push the world in a certain direction. You know, that's what gets me up in the morning. I think like I've always been, you know, a nerd also. And so the idea that like we could use these tools to further that mission has always felt like an exciting kind of thing to explore for me.
And you set up or helped set up or co-founded various kind of social change organizations / businesses quite early doors. What were the threads you were pulling on? Can you remember kind of what was the story that you were telling about what you were trying to do in those years?
I fell into digital activism, not by chance, but just kind of one thing led to another. And really that started after 9/11, when I was working as a kind of IT person at a nonprofit, and but feeling like, oh man, this is kind of a pivotal moment in the world, and ended up putting up a little website that went viral, and all of a sudden I was like in touch with 500,000 people around the world. And that was a crazy experience as a 20-year-old, and really what kind of got me, then I started having to like help people do things because people wanted to do things as a group. And so that's really what got me like into the space. So the storytelling, you know, came ex post facto in some ways, like, and there was just a lot of like doing and
making it up as you go,
trying and, you know, messing things up and trying again. That was a lot of kind of how I got into it. You know, I'll die on the hill that democracy is a wonderful ideal to aspire to, and that things are better when everybody is engaged and everybody participates in them. And you know, I think that was part of the story that I understood from what was possible with the internet. Not that it was necessarily inevitable, but that like we could realize some of these goals that, you know, have never really been fully realized of what a democracy could be.
I have a little game with myself where I try and guess what my guest's sacred value will be. And my guess for you was democracy.
Oh,
that
yeah.
It would be sense of it. What? Tell us why.
There's some value behind democracy that's probably actually the value that's like collaboration sounds too like workplacey, but it's like what happens, you know, if we were talking earlier about the like, you know, that moment of contact between two people, like, well, there are these emergent things that can happen when you actually get more than two people and everyone's like actually kind of adding something and in it for the right reasons, that I just think are really not only profound, but also like so beautifully powerful, you know, in a way that you just can't get to in other systems. There's a piece of it that's about like really recognizing what each person brings to the party. And then there's a piece of it that's about like, you can't have a party without like a bunch of people there and without like a bunch of different kinds of people there. It's not a party. Like, I care both because I think it's the best way to do things for everyone. And because I think it's like a more joyful, more human way to do things.
It's a good sales pitch. I like it. So you'd set up or been involved in Move On and then Avaaz and 2010, I guess, maybe earlier, this idea for Filter Bubble, this kind of what's now seen as a very prophetic, incredibly kind of insightful prediction, really, about a direction that we're moving in. Do you remember when you were like, okay, no, I've got to say this? Was there a sort of inciting incident?
Yeah, I mean, I was really, you know, back to curiosity, it's like I was really coming from a place of, I don't really understand what's going on. And I don't really understand what it means that, in particular, that we're moving on the web from kind of an era that was dominated by individual websites and by email to an era where everything's being pushed through these algorithmic filters in places like Facebook. And so really, you know, what the book was just like trying to figure that out. One of the fun things about writing a book is, you know, you can like call a lot of different people and ask them questions and they'll kind of like take some time with you because you're writing a book. And so I think for me, there's also this constant process of kind of like, I'm asking myself, like, is this the right question? Is this a good question? And like, the more that I like talk to other people and ask them the question, they're like, oh, that's a really good question. I don't know. The more confident I get that I'm kind of onto something. And so that was really more the process with the Filter Bubble, where I was kind of like, should we be concerned about this, you know, coming era of algorithmic personalization and what it might do to our democracy? And, you know, I was not getting a lot of like, a lot that was consoling at the time when I would ask smart people about it. And so that's really what led me into that.
And it, you know, made this very powerful argument, coined the term Filter Bubble, made this very powerful argument about personalization and the ways in which we were increasingly being shown the world that we set out already wanting to see. So a kind of reinforcing of tribes, a building of confirmation bias, where we were getting more ignorant and less and more confident in our views. And the thing that really, people have quoted this at you millions of times, but the thing that really stuck out is that thing about, if you search for, I think, Shell, one of the big energy companies, you get either results about their kind of negative impact in the world or how to invest in them, depending on your search history, which felt terrifying.
Yeah.
We are a full decade on. What has changed?
Well, I mean, we are living some of the worries that the book tried to outline, I think, in terms of a fragmented political conversation and, you know, increasingly divergent kind of understandings of the world, of the big situation that we're in. And, you know, I think also, especially among younger people, there's much more fluency with this stuff. So there's less of a, you know, I think when I wrote the book, you know, this is probably the good piece, is like, it was just all really new to a lot of people that you could even do that, you know, that Yahoo wouldn't be just showing the same front page to every person who visited it. And, you know, now now I think people are starting to kind of realize like, oh, okay, there are dynamics at work here. We're kind of starting to understand what these dynamics mean. And we're starting to understand, you know, how they can really be corrosive if they're not held in check. And so I think the conversation has advanced a lot, and it's become a much bigger, more public conversation than it was like in 2011. But I think, you know, part of what we're trying to do with this project that I'm working on now, New Public, is kind of push it past like a binary model of, you know, there's algorithmic personalization or no personalization, or there's Facebook or no Facebook, and toward kind of like, well, what do we actually want for our digital environment that represents the values that we care about, and how do we build that?
Yeah. I want to come back in a minute to that, because I think the fascinating thing about you're both a theoretician and a practitioner, which is unusual, I think, to be able to say, right, this is the problems that I see, and then go and build it. So I think part of the answer to my question is that you take agency, but I wanted to ask about kind of deep emotional thing of how do you not lose hope, given that 10 years ago you said, this looks bad, guys, and lots of the things that you predicted have come about, and we don't seem to be necessarily sure where the break is now. What's your kind of emotional journey / spiritual journey? I don't know. Like, how are there practices? Are there boundaries? Are there habits that you keep yourself able to work in this world and not, frankly, just disappear off to the woods and shout for us to unplug the internet entirely?
Yeah. I mean, there's a part of it that's just like, that's part of my disposition. And so I don't want to take too much credit for being like a
very zen.
I just like, I'm interminably hopeful. I think it was Gramsci who has this bit about pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. And that's sort of like my general approach, which is like, you know, I'm gonna like be critical, and I'm gonna think hard, and I'm gonna be really clear-eyed about all the challenges, and I'm gonna have some faith that like we're gonna get there somehow. And I don't totally know exactly how to connect those dots, but I do have that faith. And I think part of it is, this is a dicey and an awful moment in so many ways. And, you know, in human history, we've had lots and lots of these moments, and not that they don't carry real costs and real tragedy, but I'm not ready to kind of give up on the whole enterprise at the moment. I sort of feel like we need to redouble our imaginative efforts. And to the extent that we don't think we're going to solve some of these technological problems at the level that they're presenting themselves, like we need to like up our game and think about what the next level is.
Yeah. One of the key things that I can see that's changed in the last 10 years is just the level of saturation. You know, we were receiving personalized content in 2011, but we might have logged onto emails, checked our emails, gone away, done something else, you know, spent an hour browsing the internet maybe, and then gone done something else. But this is now a very much our site of character formation. Like the things that are shaping us are primarily the digital information streams that we receive. How do you think they are shaping us right now in terms of how we engage across our differences particularly?
Yeah, I think the time piece is really important. Everything ultimately just comes down to like, how are people spending time? Because when people are spending time in one way, they're not spending it in a bunch of other ways. And, you know, as a parent of young kids, and I know you have kids too, like you feel this very like acutely in terms of like, just what displaces what and what, and those calls are really important calls. And so, you know, when we're spending a lot of time with digital media, just like when we're spending a lot of time consuming movies or TV or anything else, like that displaces a whole bunch of social activity that used to happen in different ways. You know, it's like we used to go out to do clubs, do groups, do associational activities, like partly because it was entertaining.
Reward.
You know, it was like there was nothing, it was boring, and that was there to do. And, you know, now it's possible to kind of never be bored or never be at a lack for stimulation anyway. So I think that's one piece of it. Then I think there's like, how are these media, what are they incentivized to do? And so how are they structuring these relationships? And, you know, just yesterday there was a piece that came out in the Washington Post about how, you know, Facebook weighted angry reactions to content much more heavily in its decisions about what to show people than just if I liked it or even if I said I loved it or sending people a hug or whatever.
Wow. They've been telling us that that's just us, that are more likely to click on something for a negative emotion, and they're just, but no, it's the choice architecture.
Five times more visible. So what does it mean that everybody's really angry and at the same time our communications media are, you know, biased toward angering content? Like that's, you know, definitely some gasoline on the fire culturally. And I think that's what we're experiencing. So I think that makes it really hard to have relationships across difference because, you know, there's just at a kind of core, like physiological, psychological level, feeling threatened isn't a good space to develop those relationships in. When you feel threatened, it's really hard to be curious. It's really hard to be patient or interested or, you know,
empathetic.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the themes that comes through quite a lot in your work is this idea of the power of an environment. And you've spoken about the sense of wanting to contribute to a better world, the sense of the good that we want to move towards. But I feel a real skepticism in you about the power of individual choices in that versus the sense of structures. How much have you seen yourself as someone who's trying to build structures that make it easier for us to make good choices?
Yeah, I think that's a core piece of what I think, you know, public design is. And I think it's not to undermine or degrade the need for individual agency and freedom and choices, but it is, you know, the freedom's just a weird thing because at either end of the spectrum, when you have too many choices or too few choices, you're not really free. Like it isn't existential freedom. I could wake up, I could go outside and start miming, or I could like go to Brazil or whatever. Like that just quickly becomes paralysis or it becomes ennui or it's overwhelming and we can't live that way. And so, you know, part of what I think good design does is presents a legible menu of what can be done and can be done together. And, you know, to put this in concrete terms, like think about a park that has a playground and has a dog park and has a field. It's not to say like you can come up with any number of crazy things you want to do in the field, but there's a little bit of scaffolding. You know, sort of like a coral reef. Like you have to have like some amount of structure to build off in order to like have the magic happen.
I think of physical space as so in opposition to digital space because it's sensorily not. We can't grab it, right? Or touch it or feel ourselves walk through it. Or at least we can't if we're not fully in kind of VR mode. But you really do feel like we can learn a lot from physical space and import it to digital space. What's your vision there?
Yeah, well, I think it's partly about recognizing that, you know, through every society, through all of human history, we've seen this need for common spaces and for public spaces. And because they do work, they do things that private businesses and markets like won't do. There are people whose needs won't be served in the market. And if you don't have spaces and institutions that do that, so that if I can't afford a gym membership, I can still get outside and be be healthy or get some exercise, like, then you have real social problems, and those social problems generally catch up with everyone. Yeah. So part of it is just recentering our conversation about digital life by saying, like, well, we've seen the need for these public driven institutions in our physical life. Why wouldn't we need that in our digital life? Why do we think that it makes sense to try to do all of this inside of a bunch of private companies, which, even if they're run with the best possible intent and the most wise leaders, you know, that's just a very particular structure for organizing behavior and activity that's ultimately about delivering shareholder value. That's fine. But in the past, we've seen that there's utility to other ways of organizing people. And so that's part of it. But then I think, you know, when we really get into it tangibly, we can start to say, well, we have this, you know, centuries or millennia of experience designing common spaces. And there are some themes that come up again and again. And there are also some problems that come up again and again. And why would we throw all of that out and act as if, you know, here we are with a blank slate?
So I live in a big city, also I live in London, and we spent almost the entirety of lockdown in a park. And the powerful sense of, I think, other than the NHS, which people only access at moments of real crisis, public parks are the last place where everyone comes, particularly in a pandemic. But every single walk of life comes for a walk in the park if you live in a city. But I have an imaginative leap to what that means. So paint me a picture and tell me what you're trying to do with New Public. Is it a publicly owned social network? What might a space look like where everyone could come and it's that witness thing, somehow witness each other or accompany each other or even just acknowledge each other online, given the ways we've been formed to have such short attention spans, to be these sort of sensory reaction machines to our worst selves, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to a woman who was, she was actually one of the first Yahoo employees and has since had this kind of amazing career across tech. And she was saying, like, we make this mistake over and over again, which is to confuse, like, tech with, like, tech on capitalism. And there just really is this difference when you start to explore spaces that aren't organized to maximize engagement or to maximize advertising impressions. And so an example I'll give you is from Porch Forum in Vermont, which is this, it's a social network or a fancy email group. You could also think of it as, but it's an extremely heavily moderated local discussion forum. It only goes out once a day. Every post is read. And, you know, if you are not in violation of the norms, you get it sent back to you with a note that says, like, hey, this isn't quite right. Like, do you mind, like, rephrasing or whatever. So this is very high touch thing that as a business, you know, that all of that would be the first to go, right? Like, but as a service, it's incredibly well used in Vermont. It's actually like 2/3 of Vermont households are on Front Porch Forum, you know, with a pretty good spread across class. Vermont's very white, so there's not a whole lot of racial diversity. But across class, which is a big divide in Vermont, you do get these rich conversations happening. So that's just a very little example of, it's not like digital conversation as a category has to be so intractably difficult. But when you start to put the parameters around it, where, like, we're not going to invest any labor in making it good, and it's all just kind of like people fumbling around and fitting the pieces together, and by the way, we're going to amplify the most angering content, then you get what we have right now. And that's the tech on capitalism. And so I think we are interested in how do we build spaces that have these public service values at the forefront. And maybe that means they're actually nonprofits, or maybe that means they're, you know, low profit for profits that are organized around public benefit. But we just think there's a huge opportunity there for things that will really serve people in the way that parks and libraries have in the physical world.
So how much is your experience at Upworthy driving this, because I've been fascinated to see, to hear more about your experience of trying to build a for-profit business, right?
Yeah.
That amplifies content for social good. And you've talked about this tension that every, and I remember I worked at the BBC for a while, and I went into the BBC because I saw a film called Good Night and Good Luck, mm-hmm. which is about Ed Moreau yeah. and this, you know, very, we'd call them Reithian values in the UK, like BBC mm-hmm. values of the power of media platforms to educate, to inform, to form us morally and ethically.
Yeah.
But you've said, you know, every single person in every media platform, you know, old or new, comes to this thing between what sells and what is good. Stuff that matters versus stuff that sells. Did you just reach the end of how far you can go with that whilst trying to make a profit? How much was that experiment successful?
Yeah, I think we definitely reached the end of how far you can go with it while trying to make a venture scale business. And, you know, I think that was a big learning for me. It was like, oh, like media and storytelling is so important, but with some exceptions, a lot of the most important storytelling work is just not going to be at the core of a venture-backed business, because sometimes you have to invest a lot of time and energy in topics that are not especially
profitable,
you know, interesting or profitable, or and figuring out how to tell those stories that are the most important often can take more time than like churning out a bunch of trivial stuff that everybody gets already.
I'm going to ask you one final question, which is, in all of your deep dives into the intersection between our information platforms and our divisions, what is the key thing that helps us reconnect across our differences? I guess maybe one thing that individuals can do, and one thing that more on a policy or a leader level.
Well, I would say a key thing is just scale. Like, you are never going to know or be able to understand billions of people or millions of people or even hundreds of thousands of people. But like, you can make some real headway with dozens of people or like 8 people, right? And so I think like really thinking about how much time we're investing in like these fragmentary glimpses of people that we'll never know versus in relationships that actually can be bidirectional and relational, to me is like a key question, both for individuals and for designers and structure makers. Like, how do we get things down to human scale so that, because we're humans, like that's the scale we are built to get. And to me, that would be like the place to start.
Yeah, and that works at both levels. How do we design it as leaders or governments or policymakers, and how do we live it
exactly
as people?
Yeah.
Eli Paraset, thank you so much for speaking to me on The Sacred.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was a pleasure.
It's becoming clear to me that I find everyone interesting, which is why this job is such a privilege. But Eli, in particular, was not at all what I expected. My prejudices coming into this interview were that tech people and sort of startup entrepreneurial people tend to be very alpha and self-assured and pitchy. You know, here's why I'm amazing and I have all the answers. And Eli, who actually does have a TED talk, has been viewed more than 4 million times. But he wasn't like that at all. He did predict a huge amount of what's happening now, and he has all this experience and foresight, but he was just really humble and thoughtful, which was massively refreshing. The more I ask people about their childhoods, the more that very obvious thing about the formative power of our childhoods become clear to me. And you can just draw a line between Eli's parents running a non-profit school focused on children who might otherwise be excluded from education, and his sense of wanting to take what he was good at, which was tech and computers and IT, and use those skills for good. I really like his vision of digital public parks. And it is interesting when you think about it, that we are very happy for our digital public spaces to be entirely run by corporations. And I don't think he's anti-corporations in general, but just argues very well for this need for a mixed economy of public space and private space. Lots of social commentators have been arguing for a while that even in the physical, I don't think real life and online life are helpful divisions maybe, but in the physical space, we are losing our public and common space, that lots of it's being sold off. And, you know, the Victorians, social reformers, many of whom were inspired by their faith, actually, really had a strong sense of the importance of common spaces that everyone could access, that there were no barriers to. Hence all these amazing parks all over London. I live near Ruskin Park in Camberwell, which is just a lifeline and one of the few places where everyone from the community goes and everyone from the community at the very least sees each other. So I'm intrigued by what that would mean in digital space, although frankly, like most of us, I'm a bit burnt out by too much on my screen. So I'm more likely to spend time in my real life public park, but I look forward to seeing digital public parks emerge in. I think the most memorable thing that he said to me was right at the end about the human scale, the hubris actually of trying to hold all this complexity and this number of people in our heads, in front of our attention, in our imagination, and engage with problems and people at this global level when we are only human after all. And I'm going to think about that. What does it mean for me to commit to a smaller number of relationships over time in committed covenant relationships? Because that might be where we're able to be most fruitful. That's what I'm pondering after listening to that interview. I'd love to hear what you're pondering. Please do get in touch and see you next episode. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. Remember, sharing is caring, as my four-year-old says, so please do send this or another episode to a friend, rate us on Apple Podcasts, or my personal favourite, leave us a review. I really get a thrill when I see a new one pop up. Huge thanks to Abby Allison for research and production support, and Emily Down for our visual identity. We are edited by Drew Hawley, and our music is composed and arranged by Luke Stanley, with vocals by Lizzie Harvey. The Sacred is a project of the think tank Theos, and you can find out more about our work at theosthinktank.co.uk.